welcome to Yada Yada Radio and to the Shabbat edition. We've got James with us. I'm assuming that we'll have Larry here shortly. If we do have Larry.
He's here.
Welcome, everyone. You guys have had quite a lively discussion on who Moshe was and was not in the chat room. The fact is that the movie is probably what prompted the attention that is coming out. The movie on the Exodus, I've forgotten what it's called. It's a Ridley Scott movie. I'm not a fan of Ridley Scott. I think he does great cinematography, but that his character development and his the relationships that he creates and his tight casting are ridiculous. And the likelihood of Ridley Scott portraying the Exodus account even remotely accurately is extraordinarily slim. I don't know if I could endure it.
I won't bother. In the trailer, he's saying he gave me your trust. Now I'll give you my faith. You know, he's a religious moron. And
yeah,
it's just
so
hopeless.
Sad.
Another
so sad.
Lie being cast upon people.
Right.
Just really
And, of course,
sad.
It's Christian Bale playing the superhero.
Hey, John's monitoring us in the chat room. John, we don't need your tips about muting and microphones and pop mics. I unfriended you for this very reason.
Well,
you really want to delve into people. You know, you want to play prophet or whatever the hell it is you do, John. So just leave us alone. This is a family affair, and we'll let Yada run the show the way he wants. Thank you very much.
So that we have a little more discussion here on Moshe, because I think it's important. And I don't have a problem if somebody wants to go see the movie. I'm not going to go see it. And I would love to see the spectacle of it, because Ridley Scott does beautiful spectacle. But precision and accuracy are extraordinarily important to me regarding anything that has to do with God, particularly the second most important thing God has done with man on this planet. I mean, the only thing that's more important is Yahweh fulfilling the first four Moed Mikre. But second to that, the Exodus, which sets the stage for them and explains the purpose of them, is the most important thing that he has done with humankind. Because it actually includes presenting the Torah. The Torah was presented on Shavuot during the Exodus. So it's all part of the of this process. And Yahweh establishes himself not only as a liberator and a savior, but also as our father during this process, feeding his children, nourishing them in every possible way, caring for them. And so to have the story begin at any place other than the burning top of the mountain, and it was not a burning bush, where Yahweh explaining, this is who I am, and this is what I'm asking. And for Moshe to be anything other than what he was, an 80-year-old man who had come out of the worst place on earth, who was at that time in his life a broken man, really, and to present him as Christian Bale, to present him as a man of faith, to present him as this great charter, you know, come, follow me to freedom. They weren't following Moshe. They were following Yahweh.
They were following Yahweh.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not a clash of gods. It's a clash of a egotistical man who wanted the world to believe he was God, and he would never say, I am God, because he knew he wasn't God. I mean, all these, every cleric, every politician, every dictator, every king, every pharaoh, every pope knows they're living a lie. They know they're living a lie. They would never scream out, I am God. It's just not in their nature. And it's so if you have a battle between a false god, which is a god that does not exist, and the only real one. This is not a battle between gods. It's not a war between gods. There is no fight here between Egypt and Yahweh. And one of the things I did see in this, Larry, and I want to conclude with this and then turn back to the Psalm, the 119th Psalm, is that one individual, I guess, that you were communicating with there briefly was saying that Moshe might well have been religious. I hope he was.
Oh, this was John. This is John, yeah. The guy that he's in the chat room, rude.
Right.
He's the guy that has Malak visit his home and they speak in the king's English and all this.
Oh, great.
And he just is a nut.
Well, that's not good. But I will tell you
it's not good.
No, I would tell you that it is probably beneficial if Moshe was religious. It's probably beneficial if Moshe was political. It's probably beneficial if Moshe was in the Egyptian military. If he had been these things, if that had shaped his youth, then he would be in a much better position to be able to compare the failure of those things to the dependability of the teaching that Yahweh was offering. So I almost hope that he was. The implication is that he was, although we're not told. So speculation always gets you into trouble. You know, it's not a bad thing if you're speculating about the story in the Torah. But the reality is, I think he would have been even more empathetic and more understanding and more effective had he been exposed to the Egyptian religion, its politics, its military, so that his appreciation for the alternative Yahweh was offering is so much greater. I know for me, if I had not been political, religious, and pro-military and patriotic, that I would not appreciate who Yahweh is, his teaching, and his offer as much as I do, having seen the failure of those things. So while God's offer is wonderful beyond imagination, and he is wonderful beyond my comprehension, I'm going to tell you that having been on the wrong side certainly has helped me appreciate what it's the benefits of embracing the truth. I actually like the comparison. Any thoughts on that?
Well, no. I mean, I can totally understand that. It's just sort of like Eve come or Chawa coming up with this story about, oh, he said never to touch the tree. He never said not to touch the tree. You can examine it, look at it.
Right.
I guess you have to be able to expose it. You know, sadly, you know, the thing we fight, the thing we always fight, is that Yahweh is not a religious deity. I mean, this is the biggest fight we have. When people are coming out of the traditions of religion and they come into Yahweh's words and they begin to understand that he's not a religious deity, it's mind-blowing almost. Believe me. Well, you know that. You get the emails. I do, too.
Yeah, of course. And this movie will present Moshe as a religious zealot.
Yeah, sure.
I've seen the movie.
Of course.
So I expect the movie, though, because I have seen so many of Ridley Scott's movies, and in all their movies, he doesn't develop characters, but instead caricatures. And they're so thin, and they're so jaundiced, that I can't imagine him developing a character and a relationship that is anything other than religious. And in that regard, that'd be a tragedy to cast this story, to corrupt this story, to make it a clash of religions. And I'm afraid that's what it is. And you're right. That is the biggest battle we fight. By the way, I have received a number of emails here in these last few days, all supporting continuing for a while with Questioning Paul. everyone's saying the same thing, that while they enjoy the Torah, while they thrive on the Torah, those they love do not. And it is helpful for all of us, since we constantly engage those who are still polluted, particularly by Christianity, for us to focus on its flaws. I mean, its primary flaw is Paul. And so it is helpful for us to use the time we have to do the single most important thing we can do, which is to help those polluted by religion, and in our world it's Christianity, to leave that religion so that they're in a position to distance themselves from religion and have a relationship with God. And you've got to separate yourself from religion before you can do that.
Yeah, beyond having a relationship with Yahweh, and that happens through reading His words, the next most important thing that I think we'll ever do is expose the pollution out there for what it is.
Yeah. Well, the reason, first of all, God's order is very specific. I mean, the terms and conditions of the covenant are not in random order. They are very specific. And the prerequisite is to walk away from Babylon, to walk away from your country, to walk away from your father's home, to walk away from the societal customs, to walk away from the world and institution of man. That is a prerequisite. Because I don't care how much you read Yahweh's words, unless you're willing to walk away from religion, they're not going to do any good. And they're in total conflict with everything we have been told. And so, and God, frankly, doesn't want to have a relationship with a religious person. So God doesn't want to talk to a religious person. He doesn't want to have a relationship with a religious person. And a religious individual has been indoctrinated to reject evidence and reason that's opposed to their faith. And everything God has to say is in opposition to Christianity. So you have to walk away from religion, at least begin to question it, before you have any chance of coming to know who Yahweh is. And then, Larry, you're right. You can't engage in a relationship with somebody you don't know. And Yahweh only introduces Himself to us in one place, the Torah. And you can't engage in a relationship with somebody as esteemed, as powerful, as important, as singularly unique as the Creator God of the universe without knowing and understanding the terms and conditions for participating in that relationship. I mean, it's very specific. There are five terms and conditions.
It's very important.
Yeah. He's the Creator God of the universe. It's His right to establish the conditions. If you don't agree with the conditions, that's fine. You're not going to be part of His family. But if you don't know the conditions, you can't join the relationship.
Right. And it's going to be as simple as most people are not going to, meet those requirements because they don't make sense to them. What's going on out here today is you get groups of people meeting, and what do they talk about? Getting rid of all the sin in their life. Well, what is the sin? What's the greatest sin that Yahweh talks about? Well, it's religion, isn't it?
Yeah, religion.
Running around, practicing religious veneration, attaching religious notions to Him. The sin, the
false
missing
God.
Of the mark, is missing, you know, his clearly prescribed prescriptions, his choke, his pakudim, his mitzvah,
his Torah.
That's what they're all missing, and because His ways are not our ways. We might think a guy's a pretty good guy. There might be somebody I just happen to like. He's really kind of a good guy. I like the guy. But you know what? Yahweh doesn't know him.
Because the
way we lump good and bad is not the way Yahweh does it.
No,
he says in the end they won't be able to tell good from bad. Isn't that true?
Right. And
that's
clearly Yahweh's ways are different than man's religious perceptions. You know, I'm I am still almost speechless by the letter I received from a guy who initially wrote Richard of the blessyahweh.com site, and you know, was beginning to search and had lots of questions, and I don't think he and Richard hit it off initially. In fact, I had to write a couple of replies explaining why they didn't hit it off, which is that, you know, in the family, we're very blunt. I don't have time for using ploys to convince people. It's black and white with us. You either focus on and trust Yahweh's testimony or go away. We have nothing else to say. And Richard took that approach, which is the right approach. And this guy, you know, had a tough time with that. And as he was trying to decide whether he was going to continue to read or not, he says, you know, the big complaint, he says, I proceeded in reading Intro to God or Questioning Paul or yada yada, I wanted to know who I was getting this teaching from. So I want to know, what are your credentials? Who are you? And of course, my response to that was, I have none, and I'm irrelevant. And that didn't go over really well, but I tried to explain why. And then he says, you know, the big argument against your books and against you is that God is all merciful, and you say that people have to know to be saved. And yet there would have been no way for people to know for many centuries, and therefore there would have been no one saved, and therefore knowing cannot be part of the criterion for being saved by an all-merciful God. And that is the argument that that is universally used against your books, which are called, of course, Knowing Yahweh, yada yada. And I'm still speechless by that. I mean, this idea that you could be saved by a God that you don't know, that you could be saved by a God who you haven't even engaged in the relationship with, you could be saved by a God whom you have done everything the opposite of what he has asked.
Oh, yeah, he said they'll kill you, in fact. It'll kill you.
Right.
You know, and in fact, he says people that push these concepts about him, he will not fail to punish them.
And let's just say that that God somehow had a provision for trying to engage in the relationship someone who did not have access to his Torah during the horrific reign of Roman Catholicism or the horrific reign of Islam in some country. Let's just say that he had decided that he found somebody there in the world of Islam, there in the world of Roman Catholicism, or there in the world of African paganism and you know, spirit worship that he wanted to save. Let's just say that he did. How does that pertain to you? How does that pertain to anybody today? Let's just say that he
did. Just say that he did. One thing I know, Yahweh will do almost anything but break his word. And when his words are down, he means them. Now, he says very clearly that if you don't walk through my Moed Mikra, I will annihilate your soul.
Correct.
That's what he says.
Right.
You're going to be separated from the family. Now, nobody.
All right. I'm still putting it out as a hypothetical. I don't think it happened. Personally, I don't think it happened. I don't think that there was any a spirit worshiper in Africa, any bad Muslim in the Middle East, or any Roman Catholic during the medieval period that Yahweh reached out to and said, this is such an interesting individual. I'm going to save this individual, even though this individual knows nothing about me. I don't think it happened. But just say
You know, it'd be an interesting concept because there was 400 years right there in Jerusalem, right there in the land.
Right.
For 400 years, nobody understood Yahweh nor followed his path or spoke to him. 400 years,
yeah.
Where it was totally available to everybody, not
right.
One
well,
person.
Because God told us this. He says, I tried to find somebody. I couldn't find anyone. Couldn't find anyone. I wanted to reach out to my people. I couldn't find anybody to work with. Now, so you're right.
Did they have access to the Torah?
Absolutely they did. I want to make this point. Let's just say that God has a different criterion for different people at different times. Now, I am convinced that he doesn't, but let's just say he does. How does that pertain to those today who have every word that he uttered available to him or her, who have all of the world's best tools available free, interlinears and lexicons and dictionaries, to those of us who have access to books that are like Yada Yah and Intro to God, that are devoted to sharing what he shared with us, what excuse do you have today not to know him? Why would God apply a different standard to you today when he is eminently knowable today? The only thing that would separate somebody from knowing Yahweh today is lack of desire.
Well, you know, Yahweh talks about the sins of the fathers. Yeah, and you know what those are. Those are getting people off the path. Mm-hmm. And that they affect people for generations.
Right.
I want to read you Shemot here.
But before you do that, why do you think the prerequisite for participating in the covenant after it says walk away from your country, which was Babylon, which is religion and politics, and militarism, the beast that is Babylon, that the next thing he says is walk away from your father's home?
Because dad's got that poison dripping off of him.
That's correct.
Here's what he says in Shemot 26. This ought to put it to bed for anybody. They can believe this or not. But I want them to couch this. I'd like anybody that's listening to couch this in terms of, for 400 years right in the land, nobody would listen. For Noah, you had one man in a whole region. You had Dode, who was essentially out there with just a few people. Right there in the middle of the land. And here he was the king.
Mm-hmm.
You have Abraham, one guy in a whole metropolitan area. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Well, was the dominant city of Babylon and Assyria. It was the first city where we know civilization adopted religion and politics and militarism. It's the birthplace of all of those things. So yes, it was quite a place.
Yeah, he says right here in Shemoth, but I will genuinely act and actually engage to literally prepare, perform, and produce unmerited and unfailing mercy, unearned favor, and undeserved kindness on behalf of, put this in quotes, thousands who move towards me and love me, and also who approach me closely observing and carefully considering my terms and conditions. Now, if you don't know the terms and conditions, and it doesn't matter if your dad was a pagan out there in the middle of Botswana, and he stayed a pagan, and you adopted your daddy's pagan religion, you're dead.
Is there some potential doubt that that's what Yahweh said, or did he etch that statement in stone?
That was in stone, and it's clear. It's right there, thousands, which goes right back to the one in million, which goes right back to the narrow doorway and path that very few people will ever find.
Right. And by the way, that is the reason why. Well, that's not the reason why. That is one reason why. I think that the hypothetical I gave, which is that, all right, let's just presuppose, hypothetically, that Yahweh has a different standard for those and a place and time where his testimony wasn't knowable. Now, the answer to that, there are many, and one of them is that there's only going to be thousands that engage in the covenant relationship with him. And so that precludes him reaching out to many during all of these many times and places. So you're right. That's one of the reasons. But it still gets back down to, the last part of that statement, the last part of that statement that Yahweh etched in stone, is that his mercy is for the thousands who do a specific thing. And that specific thing is, say, Shamar Mitzvah.
Yeah,
they
consider, examine, they observe, they
carefully
think about
consider
them.
The terms and conditions of his relationship agreement. And there's only one place that you can study the terms and conditions of his relationship agreement. They're presented in the Torah, in the first book of the Torah, and then they're talked about throughout the prophets and Psalms. But they're only presented in one place. If you don't read them there, you've got no hope of receiving Yahweh's mercy. So when Yahweh says that his mercy is limited to thousands who do this specific thing, and when you, by the way, when you shamar, closely examine and carefully consider, you come to know the purpose. There's only one purpose of closely examining and carefully considering. There's only one result of that. That is to know. And when you realize that that is the criterion for receiving Yahweh's mercy, Yahweh clearly is not all merciful. Yahweh clearly has conditions by which you can participate in the relationship. And while those conditions don't specifically specify reading the Torah, the only one place that you can find the terms and conditions is in the Torah. While they don't specify that you have to know Yahweh, it's impossible to trust and rely upon Yahweh unless you know him. And you understand what he's offering, how to rely on it. So, God's testimony, and particularly one of the passages that you quote a lot, Larry, in this program, is that, as says Hosea 4:6, where God says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowing, because they do not know. It's pretty hard to reconcile that with knowing can't be a criterion for being saved. The antithesis of being saved is being destroyed. My people are destroyed because they do not know, which means if they knew, they wouldn't be destroyed. I mean, how anybody in their right mind can use that as an argument against an introduction to God or yada yada baffles me, because at this point...
I do. I get it. They don't know Yahweh's words, and what they know of them, they don't much like, because it runs in complete opposition to all the religious nonsense they've been taught, praying into the air through faith and all the rest of it.
Okay.
And that Yahweh's an emotion called love. If he's an emotion called love, then why does he say literally that he hates?
Yeah.
Certain people and certain things. He hates them.
Why does he call certain people an abomination? Why does he call certain people a plague of
death? Abomination. Why did he literally say, I hate Esau? I mean, you know, it all fits nicely if you're some guy making a living and trying to mislead people by twisting concepts and words and throwing in man's traditions. But as people sit around and they tell me about how they don't sin, you know, I find these people laughable, because to them, sin would be drinking too much one night or this, or, you know, being human.
Yeah,
you know,
having to repent from bad behavior. And if that was the kind of sin that Yahweh was most worried about, then the author of most of the Psalms, wouldn't have been the author of most of the Psalms. It's flatly impossible. If bad behavior was the sin that Yahweh was extracting from us, then why did Yahusha tell his disciples while bobbing up and down in the Sea of Galilee that the yeast that is being referred to on matzah that I want to have removed is the nature of the Pharisees and the scribes. You know, you're dealing with the fundamentalist religious types and the liberal political types. He says that's the essence of the yeast, of the fungus. Why
that
did he
is
use
the fungus.
Pasha, to which means rebellion, and it speaks of political and religious rebellion to describe sin. I mean, that's the word that is used for sin actually means to rebel.
You know, I've done a lot of things in my life. I really have. I've done a lot of bad things in my life. Not horrible, but I've done a lot of things.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you,
stole a case
I
of beer when
never,
you were a young man.
Yeah, I did at least that. But I got to tell 8 cases that day.
Okay, that's right. Yeah,
but,
8 cases.
Yeah. But here's something for you. No matter
because
what
you needed
I've
an
done,
internal beverage, right? It was 8. You could drink forever with 8.
We just wanted to throw a party for everybody. It looked like the big shots for the girls at the school. We did this all the time. But I have to tell you, I have never taken an employee of mine, went after his wife, and said, I'm going to think of a way to get this guy killed so
yeah,
I can fight him.
So I can add to my harem.
Yeah, I have never went that. Nor did I ever get drunk and have incest with my daughters.
No.
You know, now, you know, when people want to try to equate sin with what we call a sin, you know, I was very, very well aware we're capable of almost anything. Because we're human.
Right.
He didn't say, I want you to be perfect and then come meet me. He says, walk towards me and I'll make you perfect. It's two different things.
Yeah, you know what's really interesting about Dode is that Dode did a lot of stuff that was bad. He bore false witness. He was a traitor at one point. He lost courage at one point. He did a lot of things that you ought not to do. And yet, it was only one bad behavior that Yahweh actually acknowledged. And mostly because Yahweh doesn't pay any attention. Pay any attention to what we do that is bad, because the whole concept of the set-apart spirit is it blinds Yahweh of our bad behavior. But because Dode's such a special case, and so demonstrative of how to endear oneself to Yahweh, how to become righteous in Yahweh's eyes, how to become upright in Yahweh's eyes. Since he is the perfect example of this, and therefore a bad boy in terms of his earthly behavior, Yahweh did have to pay attention to one of Dode's sins. One. Only one. There's only one that he speaks out against and says, you know, that you're going to get a timeout for that. There has to be a consequence of that, and it was adultery. Now this is a guy.
Well, it wasn't just adultery; it was having a guy killed in adultery and all kinds of things.
Yeah,
it was a pretty low blow.
Right. Yeah, murder.
And no matter, I've never known anybody that's. I've known some people, and I've never known anybody
in a military conquest and sending your general out to be involved in a military conquest so that he would be killed, so that he could. Take his wife, which says that in that one act he was engaging in something that was thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not make a habit of killing. Well, this he was making a practice of killing at this point, and you shouldn't continue to commit adultery. He was making a practice of that too, a real habit of it, and so it was. And he was even bearing false witness. He was deceiving the general about the reason that he was being sent out. So, I mean, it was like the coveting was part of it too. It's like
he was doing it all. You know,
he was doing it all, man.
Right.
It was the place where he says, you know, I think I need to make an example here and say, you know, it's not going to affect my relationship with Dode, but it sure as hell is going to cause me to say, this isn't right. This isn't right. He is my child. I love him. But this isn't right. And so.
And that's what you would expect out of a good father. You wouldn't want some king. Say it's Saddam Hussein, where he's got his son out walking in raping women as they're getting married. you know, grabbing him right off the stage and so forth. I mean, this is not the kind of king or the kind of father that Yahweh is going to be. He's going to be one that, you know, his kids know how to behave. And it shouldn't be out of fear. It should be because they want to behave. I know I want to.
Yes, exactly. So, bottom line here is that the most thorough and complete explanation of how to observe the Torah is presented in the 119th Psalm. I mean, there is no question about that. The 119th Psalm is written precisely for one reason, and that is to go through the letters of the Hebrew alphabet because they are the means to communication in alphabetical order and go through each of the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet in the order that they are listed alphabetically and to take the most important words that are formed by those letters and then to convey to us how to observe the Torah. And what Dode says is that there's four things that you ought to focus on. And those four things are very specific. Now, they are the mitzvah, which are the terms and conditions of the covenant. They are the misfat, which are the means that Yahweh uses to justly justify us, to resolve this rebellion that we have had prior to engaging in the family. The choke, which is that which is inscribed in stone that cuts us into the relationship. And the pekudim, which is the information that we need to know, the prescriptions that we need to know to properly respond to Yahweh. He says, that's what's in the Torah. And he says, you need to focus on those things. And once you've come to know those things, once you've come to understand those things, once you've made the connections on those things, then you're in a position to respond to it. That's the message of this psalm. And so if you take that approach, that coming to know and loving and respecting Yahweh based upon those four aspects of the Torah and then responding to him based upon them, if you take that position and you say that's how you shamar Torah, then you're consistent with the one person that Yahweh called out to say, I love him. He is upright. He's righteous. In fact, he is so special to me that I, as God, when I return to earth and I set up my millennial kingdom on earth, I'm going to establish it just as was the kingdom of Dode. I mean, God's going to establish his kingdom in the name of this individual. So don't you think that his 176 statement song on how to properly observe the Torah is trustworthy? Me think
most
so.
Most definitely.
You know, me think so. It's pretty straightforward. So let's jump back in at 151. It is one of my favorites. We've been over this before. Shoot me for being repetitive, but this is one of my favorite statements. Yahweh, you are approachable and desirous of close, personal, and intimate relationships. This is brought to us by the Hebrew letter Keth, which is the picture of the sun rising on the horizon. It's the beginning of the light of the new day, the hope of the new day. I personally think it as the perspective, because when you look at the horizon, you gain a perspective. It's the perspective that the light provides. That's how I define this letter. Now, am I reading into it? Yeah. But, you know, I've got a personal relationship with the author of this language. And that's what the letter says to me. Now, it might say something additional or else to you, but I see the coat, which is the light, the sun's light rising on the horizon as providing perspective, the light providing perspective. And it says, and so these are all Koth words. The most important Koth word is kara. But this one is karab. Karab is approachable, close, personal, intimate relationships. Proximity for the purpose of kinship and familial association. Karab is as powerful a term as you could possibly have regarding the purpose of the Torah. Yahweh. Now, this is not Jesus. This is not the Lord. This is not Christ. This is not Allah. This is not Yahweh. Yahweh. You are approachable and desirous of personal and intimate relationships. Karob. And all of the terms and conditions of your relationship agreement, mitzvah, are trustworthy and reliable, dependable and true, enduring and everlasting. Amen. We devoted an entire show to a passage that that underscored the appropriateness of the highly controversial definition that I have for mitzvot as the means for Yahweh to resolve disputes. And the passage explained that the means that Yahweh uses to resolve disputes is the very thing that makes us tzedak, vindicated. And I said, there is no way, folks, to translate this any other way in this context. The context defines the term and therefore supports the definition that mitzvot is the means that Yahweh uses to resolve disputes. Well, I would say that the single most controversial definition, if you were a religious person and you wanted to quibble with my translations, the first word you'd go to would be mitzvah. Mitzvah is universally translated command throughout every English Bible translation. Mitzvah is always translated command.
Can I add something here?
Go ahead.
That's for those of you, that's for the religious people that believe you're a wind-up doll and that you're being controlled in your life. There's like little strings. Maybe you're a puppet.
Right.
But what has escaped you is the concept of free will.
Correct.
Free will.
Right. Now, here, mitzvah is defined by Yahweh in this context. And it cannot be command or commandment in this context, because a command and a close, personal, intimate relationship are the antithesis of one another. It's like saying Lord and Father. They're oil and water. They're opposites. Command and commandment and being desirous of close personal relationships, being approachable. Those things are exactly the opposite. You give someone a command for them to go off and do your bidding. You give someone a command that must follow your orders. If you were to try to give a command as a woman to your husband or as a husband to your wife, as someone you love that you have a close personal relationship with you, they're going to look at you like, are you out of your ever-loving gourd? Well, the same thing.
Yeah, I tried that a few times. Patty just laughed in my face.
I mean, you can do it for giggles, for laughs, but that's it.
I do that to her sometimes.
I don't even kid like that.
She's like, you could ask nicely. I go, Paul said you're supposed to obey me. I'm kidding.
I know. Being facetious is my wife would not. It's like Larry, I wouldn't even try it. Your wife knows you're being facetious. I wouldn't even try it. This particular statement in Psalm 119, 151 affirms that the translation of mitzvah as terms and conditions of the relationship is accurate. Yahweh, you are approachable and desirous of close, personal, and intimate relationships. All of the terms and conditions of your relationship agreement, mitzvah, are trustworthy and reliable, dependable and true, enduring and everlasting. These concepts do not fit together if mitzvah is a command. God can command a lot of stuff if he wishes to. He can command the energy to become matter. If he wishes to do that, and he's done it. He can command if he wishes to. But one thing he cannot command is close personal relationships. God cannot command love. It's impossible. Even God can't. I mean, the reason that God created a system with a concept as prone to disaster as free will. I mean, and look at free will. I mean, it is the most haphazard and most prone to absolute disaster of anything God ever conceived is free will. God didn't conceive free will, would not have conceived free will, if he could command love, if he could command relationships that were meaningful.
Or if he controlled you, was with you 24 hours a day and talking in your ear. I mean, what do you suppose it is that got God to, say, get a guy like John Wayne Gacy to rape and murder, you know, 20-some teenage boys? I mean, what do you think did that? What part of God was there with him was that?
Obviously.
I mean, you know, we might as well just break it right down for him. I mean, it gets to a point of religious insanity. You know, we're to have an open mind. The Mizmor tells us that. But, you know, we're not to have our brains fall out of our head because our heads are open. It's at a point where, once this is presented to you in terms of free will, Yahweh is not with you 24 hours a day. You know, when I'm sitting on a toilet, and I don't want to be crass here, I don't want him with me, okay? I don't know how else to break this down for people.
Yeah.
You know, you spend time with Yahweh and his words on his called out days and his Shabbat, and he's there with you. And the Ruach's feeding you all that time.
Yeah.
And here, at some point,
talking about the terms and conditions of his covenant, his mitzvah. And what he says is that the mitzvah are trustworthy and reliable, dependable and true, enduring and everlasting. When Yahweh said, as the second codicil of the covenant, the second term and condition of the covenant, to trust and rely on me, do you think there's a tie-in here to the mitzvah being the thing that is trustworthy and reliable, and trust and rely? I mean, God
says,
I want you to walk away from religion, and instead of human institutions, I want you to trust and rely on me. What Dode is saying right here is that the thing that's trustworthy and reliable, the terms and conditions of the covenant. By the way, I'm getting a whole lot of now messages, second message now, from John. I'm not going back.
Oh,
I understand that, Larry, you and John don't see eye to eye. I was uncomfortable with many of the things that John communicated to me early on as well. I don't know John all that well. I really don't. And I read some of the stuff in the chat room, and I was a little uncomfortable with what I read. But the fact of the matter is, that's not the purpose of the show. I don't care. We're not going to create time out for two people to go at it and condemn one another or exonerate one another. We're going to continue with the psalm. I'm not going back there. All right? So what we find with the mitzvah is that the terms and conditions are not only trustworthy and reliable, and they have to be. And that's what God is saying, is that if you want to engage in a relationship with me and therefore be saved by me, I've got terms and conditions, and they're trustworthy and reliable. For them to be trustworthy and reliable, alternatives to them cannot be. And for them to be enduring and everlasting, then we can't have a new variation. There's only one set of terms and conditions, and they are trustworthy and reliable, which means for those who would say, well, you know, I'm not going to know. I'm not going to take the time to know what God said. And I'm not going to pay any attention to the invitations to meet with him, because that requires knowing, because a merciful God would save people that did not know him at times where it was more difficult to know him. And my point to those would be, if God laid out terms and conditions to be part of his family and made them knowable, and you choose not to know them, then shame on you. Because what he said is that what he has provided, what he has promised, what he has laid out is dependable, eternal and everlasting. Which means if you come to know him as he presented himself, if you come to understand what he's offering and you act upon it, you're golden. So why would you care
that's
about anything
free
else?
Will.
Yeah.
That's called free will. And that's how real relationships happen. You just said it yourself. You can't command somebody to love you, like you, respect you. You can't force yourself on them if they don't want to be around you. Well, I guess you can, but then you'd be like a stalker or a weirdo or something like that. And, you know, we're right back to what does this all mean? Well, it means terms and conditions, doesn't it? That doesn't... You know, he's not talking about his instructions aren't commands. He never commanded anything, as far as I know. I suppose he commands Malak. You know, I suppose
it's appropriate for him to command Malak. That's what they were designed for. And if God wants to command, it is his universe. He's entitled to do so.
he surely doesn't do it with me.
But Yahweh has placed limitations on himself, so we can place limitations. We can place the same limitations on him that he has placed on himself. That's what testimony that is credible and reliable means. So if God says that he wants, it's his desire for us to engage in a close personal relationship with him, as that statement just said, then we can take him at his word, which means that he is not interested in forced relationships, that he is not interested in a command performance or being feared, because those things are in conflict with what he said. It also means that God can't change his mind. Sorry, but he can't change. He said what he said is dependable and reliable forever. He can't change. He can't say, you know, that those terms and conditions of the covenant, I don't like them anymore. I'm going to negate them. I'm going to tell you that if you relied on them in the past too damn bad, I'm changing my mind. I'm going to come up with a different plan. Even if the different plan were better, he can't do it. He can't do it. You know, I understand that he's the most powerful entity in the universe. There's lots of things he can't do. And that's one of them. Doug goes on to say, long ago, I came to literally know and completely understand from your enduring testimony and restoring witness that you indeed laid the foundation to establish me forever. I wish... in many ways, that I were like Dode in this regard. Now, I don't know how old he is when he's writing this. And he says, you know, long ago he came to literally know Yada. And by the way, the fact that Dode says that he came to know Yada certainly negates the critics of Yada Yahn questioning Paul, doesn't it? It says, long ago It didn't say long ago I came to faith. It didn't say, long ago I came to want. It didn't say, long ago I came to believe. It says, long ago I came to Yada. I was made totally aware and shown. I found out and acquired the information needed to discover. I became familiar with, accepted, and acknowledged in the call perfect. Literal and complete. That's what call perfect. Literal and complete. And so... Dode is in this position because he came to know. Now, long ago is a statement that You know, I wish in some regard that I had come to know him 10 or 20 years earlier. Things would have been a lot different. But, you know, there's some advantages of being a little more like Moshe and coming to know him later rather than earlier. Because sometimes having those experiences with politics and religion and patriotism and all that sort of thing and business kind of prepares you to be a little bit more effective maybe and exposing and criticizing those things. I mean, there's not a lot of people that are going to come at me as a Christian and come up with some unique justification for Christianity that I haven't heard. You know, I was one of them. There's not somebody that's going to come and explain how America's move towards socialism is going to somehow prevail. And I've been in business. I've built businesses. I know what it's like. You know, there's an advantage of having a checkered past, and my past is checkered. But Dode was long ago. He was a young man when he came to know Yahweh. So he has really grown up his whole life in the family. That's a different perspective than you and I've had, but still he came to know. So long ago, Kedem, speaking of an unlimited duration of time by using the reference of the eastern and therefore rising sun. So Kedem, by the way, is the very definition of this letter that is bringing us. This is the last verse in the brought to us by this letter. And he's defining the letter long ago. Speaking of an unlimited duration of time. And let's put that concept into, add that concept, if we could, to, you know, my definition of this letter, which is the picture of the rising sun on the horizon, and I said it provides perspective, the light providing us with perspective. If I were to tell you the single most important perspective that I have come to relating to the Hebrew words that comprise the Torah, if I were to pick out one of all of them, you know the one I'm going to pick? Time. Hebrew words are not stuck in time. They represent Yahweh because every Hebrew verb is eternal in time. It was true, is true, will be true. And so what this is doing, he's defining that letter by saying that it speaks of the duration of time. If you have the perspective on the Torah that every one of its verbs are liberated in time and therefore reflect Yahweh, that Hebrew and only Hebrew can properly reflect who Yahweh is because he, like light, is unlimited in time, so is the Hebrew language. And when you see the Torah as, the English word is terrible, timeless, but if you see the Torah as existing for all time, and that every actionable statement in the Torah exists for all time, if that is your perspective on the Torah, then you're a long way to transitioning from knowing to understanding. Now, maybe I'm reading too much into Kedem here. This is the last Koth word of this series, but I think that's what he's saying. He says, this is what the letter means to me. It provides a perspective on time. And by having that perspective of an unlimited amount of time, because every Hebrew verb is unlimited in time, that's how we came to know. I don't know if I'm unique in this regard or it resonated with you fellows as well. But the moment it dawned on me, and it took me a long time, when I was trying to, and I think it was this concept was called the prophetic tense, and I bought into the rabbinic argument that the prophetic tense was Yahweh writing in the past tense about things that would happen in the future, because he was so certain from his perspective they had already happened, so that he could report them before they happened as if they had already occurred. And that was my extrapolation.
That's their perspective?
Of the
rabbinic relativity?
Well, you know, I actually wrote that in Yarayan in early editions, because I was trying to understand why English transitions had things that were going to happen in the future written in past tense. And it was, and I think it was my former writing partner said, well, this is the reason, and I extrapolated on it. And then so you know, that was my perspective, is that, you know, somehow that the rabbis had somebody had a better understanding of the Hebrew tenses and knew when to choose past, present, and future. And it was only after about the third pass of translating the Hebrew that I realized, wait a minute. Every time I look at the Hebrew and I really study the conjugations, what I'm learning is that there is no reference to time. These verbs are true throughout time. They're not stuck in time, and therefore, this language represents Yahweh. You want to see Yahweh? Read his Torah. Because his presentation is eternal in time, because the words are eternal in time.
Well, you just talked about how Yahweh, you know, here's what he says. He says this is for all time. That's what he means,
right?
I mean, that's literally what he says.
So
now there are people saying he changed his mind, right? And he decided to get off on a religious path and get people to worship his physical manifestation. Well, if they understood Yahweh from the perspective of light, from his perspective. He's only 6 days into this.
Right. Exactly.
That'd be a mighty big change in 6 days' time.
Yeah, by the way, he is six days into it. We haven't completed the sixth day yet. We're close to completing the sixth day, but we haven't completed it yet.
Yeah,
but by the way, you know, one of the aspects of Christianity shows this lack of appreciation of unlimited in time. And that is the idea that their God was born on Christmas Day and then their God died on Good Friday. An unlimited God, a God who is unlimited by time, who is not constrained by time, cannot be born and cannot die. That's just a statement of fact. So the very basis of Christianity, of God being born and of God dying, is inconsistent with what Dode is saying here and inconsistent with the very nature of God. So if I were to repositioned kedem as the literal definition, which is speaking of an unlimited duration of time, I came to literally know and completely understand. That was the trigger for me. I mean, that was the aha moment for me when I realized that, and this was something profound for me, that so many people had told me that, wouldn't you have loved to have been one of the children of Israel on the Exodus and walking out there with God, actually getting to see him as the blazing light and hearing his voice? What an advantage they had. And the moment I realized that the words we were reading in the Torah spoke of an unlimited duration of time and therefore reflected Yahweh perfectly, I said, no. We are in the advantaged position. We get to see Yahweh actually as he is. We get a clearer view of him and can see him more accurately than they could. I would rather be here with the Torah and being able to see him this way and understand the nature of this language. I think we have a tremendous advantage. We have every opportunity.
Well, we do, but people are thinking they'd like to be in that position with what they know today. Now, that would be a totally different thing. But they didn't
anything. I'd much rather be where we are.
Your odds are better. Oh. I think your odds are
Well, we're able to understand things that they had no chance of understanding.
Correct.
The relative nature of time.
Right.
The actual historical evidence of the creation account and how it syncs up. All this was beyond their scope.
Hugely beneficial for us. I mean, I think we are living at the absolute optimal time to know Yahweh, engage in the covenant. I don't think you could be at a better place in time than we are. I think we are extraordinarily
history.
Yes.
Isn't that one of the predictions that in the end that the Ruach is going to be poured out on the face of the planet?
And it actually speaks of the healing messenger and the beneficial message being known around the world. And so, and it is known around the world. We have listeners to this program that are down under and up above. I mean, is far north as the Baltic, and as far south as New Zealand and Australia, around the world, from top to bottom, from east to west, we have listeners to this program, and we have readers of Yada Yah and Intro to God and Questioning Paul. Richard sent me an email a couple of months ago with the listing of the nations from which readers to his site, which present these this material, have come. I think it's over 100 countries. And I want to tell you, when I tracked Prophet of Doom and Yada Yah in the early days, same exact experience. The truth is available now. More easily, more readily, more completely than at any time in human history. Now, there's one thing I would love to have. I would love to be able to go into Yirmiyah's grotto at the base of the Golgotha Bluff of Mount Moriah, and I would love to have to look at, even if I just photographed it, the original copy of the Torah. That's right there. The original copy of the Torah. And do I know that for certain in terms of, was it revealed to me? Was it stated? Yes, it was revealed to me. Personally, no. Where did Yahweh say that the Torah was always to be in relationship to the Ark of the Covenant? Beside it, right? So it's beside it.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, it's beside it. So I am certain that it is beside it. And I would love to have access to it, and I would love to be able to translate from the original autograph. that would be spectacular, given the opportunity to. So that would be the one thing that I would like to have that I don't currently have. But, you know, we've got more than enough of his enduring, of his Edah, of his enduring testimony and restoring witness, that he, in fact, laid the foundations to establishment. What is the foundation? In fact, we have William on the line here. William, if I were to ask you, what is the most important foundation, what would your answer be?
How you doing, Yada? How you doing, Larry? Baby. The most important foundation?
Yep. What is the foundation?
It's Torah.
There you go. So, from his enduring testimony and his foundation, which is the Torah, he laid the foundation. He laid the Torah before us forever for a specific purpose. So that throughout time, Kadem, we could come to literally know and completely understand that it is his enduring and restoring witness. It's beautiful, isn't it? It's just...
Yes, it is. But the next time William comes on, would you ask that in the form of a question? So that way when he answers, I can say, no, sorry.
I'm not telling William no. I like William.
Yeah, well, I'd only do that to William, so I must like him too.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about you, William, and I've said this before, and say it again. There is, and maybe it's just me, and if this makes you uncomfortable, I apologize. But I hear in your voice what I expect to hear in Yahweh's voice. There's a characteristic of your voice that reflects your attitude, your love of family, your love of the covenant. You're just I hear it as a genuine trust of who Yahweh is, what He's offering, and a overriding desire to share that with those that you love. That is what comes across in your voice. It is the most remarkable voice. I mean, Larry's got a voice made for radio. I mean, his voice is
yes,
to die
he
for.
Does.
He does. But there's a tenor, there's a tone to your voice that conveys an attitude and a love and a passion and a commitment to, and particularly to family. And I hear all of that in your voice. It's just, you're just my favorite, I've got to tell you.
Thank you, Ed. I certainly, I'm blown away. I mean, I don't know if I don't know how you got all that out of my voice, but I certainly do try to live that way.
Well, what he said was true, and I'm going to pile on here just a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. And here it is. And you know me, William. I don't butter people up. What I do know is that very, very few people that I know that are part of the covenant have brought so many of their family with them.
Yes.
You know, there's a reason for that.
There's a reason for that, and that is because the way that you convey the truth is so genuine and so deep and so rich that I can't imagine listening to you and not being moved. I mean, I listened to you, and I moved, and I already know Him. You know, I know and love the Father, and I listened to you, and I moved. It's a you've been given a and have developed an extraordinary tool there, William.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate that. Hopefully, you know, it's not me; it's Yah's words. So,
of course, that's what you're conveying. That's
His
who
truth,
you know.
Right? Yeah, that's all I do is relay His words. And you know, I mean, if you're listening, if you have open ears, then you truly are seeking to have a relationship with Yah, and those who are listening will hearken to His voice. You know,
yeah,
hearken
to
His.
Pink writes, Willie's voice has a strength tempered with knowledge and love. You know, it's a combination, and it's not just the tone of your voice, it's what you say and how you say it. But your voice to me comes across as this marvelous blend of strength and humility. And that's how I see Yahweh. I see our Heavenly Father as unbelievably powerful and yet stunningly humble.
Well,
and that tone of powerful humility is, I guess, it's something I personally aspire to, because that's the thing that I've come to love in Yahweh. Personally, I hear Him in your voice and words.
Thank you. I I was just happy to be here with everyone tonight, because it was a rough week, and you know, I posted earlier that it's the most terrible time of the year.
It is.
Because it's horrible. I mean, everywhere you go, you see these Christmas trees everywhere, and
yeah.
But I
Christmas
did have
carols.
An encouraging story.
Yes, please.
I guess it'd be my, you know, the guy I report to, his superior. You know, we were hanging out yesterday and just talking a little bit, and he was like, yeah, you know, you have to come to Christmas party, you know, and I said, no, I can't make it, you know, and he said, no, you have to be there. And I'm like, well, you know, I said, I'm going to be traveling that day or whatever, and I said, but I don't celebrate Christmas, I told him, and he looked at me like, whoa.
Whoa.
Like, what's wrong with this guy, you know? And then he says, oh, no, don't take it that way because it's still technically a work atmosphere, right? So he's like, well, you know, he goes, well, why don't you? And he's like a diehard Christian.
Wow, so he actually says, so why don't you?
Right, right. So why don't you?
Okay.
I don't understand, he tells me. He goes, I mean, we believe the same things, right? He goes, we believe the same things, right? And I didn't want to get into great detail, so I just said.
Now, this is your boss's boss?
You know, we don't believe every. This is my boss's boss, yeah.
Okay, all right.
And I said, well, you know, we kind of do, I guess, but you just don't know. And then he looked at me and he goes, that's interesting. You know, and so I've shared with him a little bit because he kind of invited it. You know, he was,
right.
When I first started talking to him, you know, he did the Christian thing or whatever. And,
right.
You know, the only real thing that we may have in common is that we know that there is one creator. That, you know, he sent the Messiah, and that's about it. He doesn't know anything else, in essence. So, in that regard, I guess we could say that we believe the same thing in that respect, but, you know, like I told him, you don't know. And one day I plan to explain that to him in more detail, if he gives me the opportunity.
Yeah, I think that is the difference. You know, when I was a Christian, I believed. Now that I'm in the relationship with Yahweh, I know. And knowing and believing, the difference is so remarkably extreme. One is comfortable. One is liberating. I mean, to know is liberating. You can relax
really
when
is.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, if for example, I went up to somebody that I did not know, and I was desperate. I needed water. I was thirsty. I needed protection. There were bad guys coming up, and I believed this person would help me. I'm still going to be pensive, but if I know that person, and I know that they would give their own life to save me and my family, then I'm going to completely relax. I mean, it's the difference between believing and knowing.
There's two camps, isn't there? There's Azab and then there's Berith. And I have to say, you know, if I have a relationship with somebody, believe me, I know I have a relationship with them. I don't have to believe it or think it or hope it into existence. It either exists or it doesn't. And that's the covenant. There's either a Zob, which is the side you don't want to be on.
Right.
Or you're part of the covenant. And that's what
right.
it is. It's a relational family covenant. It's Berith.
Yeah. And, you know, when somebody invites me to participate in something like Christmas, you know, I will answer just as you did, which is, you know, I don't celebrate Christmas. And, you know, why? Well, because it is a pagan holiday. Because God wasn't born. Because there is no Jesus. Now,
I told him to read Jeremiah 10 because he's a pretty intelligent guy, and he actually pulled out his iPhone and he was like, Jeremiah 10, you know, but it was too loud and he wanted to read it right then and there. But hopefully he did read it. I mean, I think that it's really detailed and it lays out the Christmas tree if you read it.
Absolutely.
If you're paying attention.
Spot on.
It's spot on, right. You know, the only thing he didn't say was the Christmas tree, but
right.
You know, I mean it is spot on. And so
my view on this, I think William's the same as yours, which is that if you try to impose what you know upon him while he is religious, all it's going to create is animosity, and it'll push him further away.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is no purpose, no benefit of doing that.
No.
If he shows an interest, like if he comes back and said, you know, I read that Jeremiah 10 thing. He seems to be talking about the Christmas tree, doesn't it? And if he shows an interest, and you can say to him, listen, I like you. I sense that you would genuinely like to know the truth. And if you do, and you want to take some time, you know, apart from work, any day, any time, and you want to know what I've come to know from the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, my friend, I'll share it with you. It's got to be, you've got to take the initiative. It's got to be because you want to know. It's got to be apart from work. And I'll devote whatever time you'd like to sharing the single most important thing you'll ever hear in your life.
Right.
Yeah. And that's what I tell people all the time when I meet them, and they show a little bit of an interest. As I say, you know, what I'm going to share with you is going to destroy everything you've ever believed. And it's going to replace it with the most marvelous truth you could ever possibly imagine. But you've got to be ready for it. You've got to want it. And if you do, we'll set time apart and we'll meet and we'll go through it and we'll discuss it.
Man, and because he's so religious, that at one point he goes, but I don't understand. He goes, why don't you? He goes, what, you know, I don't get it. Because, right, it's a religious holiday or whatever, right? So I'm
right.
Like, I said, because God doesn't want us to do that.
Right.
And then that's what I kind of messed the story up. That's when he said, but no, we believe in the same thing.
Yeah.
You know,
well, we
it's
don't.
Just,
no, no. This
really
religious
don't,
holiday,
right,
I mean, yeah, this religious holiday was conceived in Babylon. It was celebrated in pagan Rome. And it's about the birth of the sun of the sun. And fact is that God's eternal. He was not born.
Yeah, my little brother actually texted me. I'm sorry, go ahead. I apologize.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was actually just to say that as you're talking about Christmas, it's pretty straightforward. God was not born. You cannot be celebrating the birth of God. Christmas is never mentioned in the Torah, prophets, Psalms, or even in the Christian New Testament. It is a purely pagan holiday. It's the very practice of the Gentiles that Yahweh said, do not follow, do not emulate what they do.
That's right.
You know, it's funny, my brother and sister-in-law, this is the first year they're not going to be celebrating Christmas. And they have a son who's about 8 or 9. I'm so bad I don't remember his exact age. But my sister-in-law was trying to explain to him why they weren't. And what she did was she opened up the verse. She pointed to Jeremiah, and she started reading it to him. And before they even got halfway through that section, he looked at her and goes, he's talking about a Christmas tree, isn't he?
Yeah. That's
right.
It's that clear. An 8-year-old kid gets it.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, he's talking about a Christmas tree.
You know,
that's
really amazing. That's really amazing, because who was Jeremiah talking to?
Gentiles.
He was talking to
Gentiles.
To the tribes of Israel that would go out and forget who they are, wasn't he?
Well, Jeremiah is a very different book than the rest of the prophetic books. You know, Yahshayah spoke only to the children of Israel, and we gain from what he had to say to them because, you know, even the Torah speaks to the children of Israel and through them to us. Jeremiah begins by saying, this was written for the Gentiles. Now, what it does is it uses the example of Yisrael. So you're right. It uses the example of Yisrael to alert Gentiles as to what we should not do. You know, the Israelites had so emulated the practices of the Gentiles that Yahweh was now in a position to use the Israelites to tell us Gentiles what we shouldn't do. but that's the basis of Jeremiah. You know, when I first read it, I said, okay, it's to the Gentiles. Now, there's no other book written that's to the Gentiles. And then I realized that the example all the way through is the Israelites. Then it dawned on me that, you know, in all the other prophetic books, Yahweh is using the Gentiles. He's speaking to the Israelites and telling them not to emulate the Gentiles. And in Jeremiah, it got so bad. Yahweh is speaking to the Gentiles and telling them not to emulate the Israelites.
And that means that when those people left there, but take it one step further, that means when those people left the land,
uh-huh.
And they did,
yeah.
That's what they were doing. And that's what they took with them.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because Yirmiyah was written in the at the time of the enslavement in Babylon. It preceded and overlapped the enslavement and Babylon, and that is what they took with them to Babylon. That's why they came out of Babylon so horribly corrupted. That's why for the 400 years thereafter, Yahweh said, I wanted to find someone. I looked, I searched for someone that I could communicate through and couldn't find anyone.
Wow.
Yes, indeed. Israelites became the Babylon. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, my little brother, he texted me a few days ago. Actually, I think it was last weekend. I guess he was thinking about things, and and he said, he sends this text, and he says, he goes, you know, I could prove God's existence. And I said, oh, okay, you know, what are you thinking about? And he's like, he's more agnostic, by the way. And he says, how do you explain fingerprints? Like, every single human being, no one's fingerprints are identical, not one. He goes, how does a woman's body understand not to replicate? Like, how does that happen? And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
what he's saying is that every one of us is different. We all have, therefore, if you take go from the fingerprint to the soul, is that we all have
right.
a very unique soul that is uniquely ours. And by the way, what's interesting too is he chose the part of the anatomy that distinguishes us from other animals and makes us most like God, the hand. That is the unique part of the human anatomy that became the basis for the terms and conditions of the covenant, for the benefits of the covenant, but most importantly, for Yahweh's name. There's five hands in Yahweh's name, and Yahweh, the first letter of Yahweh's name is hand. It's the hand that can reach out. It's the hand that can touch in love. It's the hand that can give. It is the hand that can reach down and lift up. It's the hand that represents what we're able to do and how we respond. And so, you know, it even says that we should cling to Yahweh. We use our hands. So he focused on the right part of the anatomy, too.
Yeah, I mean, and even, I mean, if we start to dissect the human body and look at all, you know, our vision and how that process, our mind, you know, our brain, how that works.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And
I would agree. I think that the eye is proof of a creator.
Right. I mean, the way it receives information and processes, and then we have vision, right? We have sight.
Right.
That just blows me away.
Take that sight and then take the single most important instruction that Yahweh gives us, Shamar.
Right.
To use sight, right?
That's
to
correct.
Read his testimony.
That's correct.
That's right.
I mean, in fact, I think we've spoken about this in the past, but the planet Earth isn't old enough for us to have evolved into what we are today.
No.
That's what I was about to say. The fact that life exists on this planet at all,
in
the time frame we have, proves God's existence.
Right.
The reason that science has changed their rhetoric. Scientists used to say that evolution was a fact because even though the spontaneous generation of life and the evolution of primitive life to complex life is improbable to the point of appearing impossible. An infinite amount of time essentially makes the improbable probable. But what we have learned is that the Cambrian explosion, during it, all 30-some forms of animal life all came to existence at exactly the same time. Right. And so it made this the proclamation of evolution false. That's why the journals of science all had to put run a retraction and say that basis for evolution has been shown to be false. And what the science has tried to do since that time is to focus on asteroids and comets. And their claim now is that, well, life therefore evolved on another planetary system where there was much more time for the improbable to become probable, and then it traveled here on a comet. Now,
managed to survive the atmospheric entrance.
So here is a life form that it can endure what would in fact be billions of years without any nourishment and extreme cold, and then go from extreme cold to temperatures that turn elements into a fourth phase. You know, there's solid, there's liquid and gas. Well, plasma is a fourth phase of energy. It is so hot that things exist as plasma that are completely different. And on entry into the Earth's atmosphere, anything on that comet would be exposed to plasma. And now you're going to tell me that's how life came here? And just think these things through, folks. Well, of course there's a creator. It's obvious.
It's like the whole idea that eventually science will answer everything. I was watching, I can't remember what it was I was watching, but they brought up the point, you know, literally for every scientific discovery we have, for every answer we get in science, we raise at a minimum a dozen more questions.
Of course.
So at that rate, you know, what we don't know grows much faster than what we do know. So the idea that science will eventually answer everything is impossible.
Ludicrous, no. All it does is raise more questions. You know, it's the whole idea of you go back 75 years ago, and 90% of those, maybe more, in the scientific community viewed the universe as a constant. It had always existed. The idea that the universe was created was a religious myth to them that was repugnant. And yet Yahweh said, no, the universe was created, and it is continuing to expand. And when they found through the Hubble shift, the red shift that Hubble discovered, that the universe is expanding, and therefore it had a place, a time where it was smaller than it is now, and therefore it had a genesis, and all of a sudden scientists came up with the concept of the Big Bang and actually copied Yahweh's own testimony. At that point, science should have realized, wait a minute, the Torah's had it right from the beginning, and we've been wrong. Now, shouldn't we admit that there is a God, and therefore, since there was a creation, there was a creator? It was such an opportune time, but they were unwilling to go there. And
how about the Mizmor that describes relativity? Come on.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you have a specific psalm, a Mizmor, that describes relativity. And in the second day of creation, as the universe is expanding and Yahweh is presenting the nature of things, he uses the Hebrew concept for relativity three or four times in the explanation of what's going on in the second day. But even in the first day, where Yahweh is speaking light into existence, and then light ultimately, energy ultimately coalesces to begin time, it's a perfectly accurate depiction of what occurred. And yeah, it's why I think that if you read Bereshith, Genesis, in Hebrew, knowing what we have come to learn, it is impossible to come to the conclusion that Yahweh, the author of that text, is anything other than the creator God of the universe.
Well, get into some depth there where you're talking about, okay, he's painting a picture here, and he's talking about, you know, several different items at once, and they all fit perfect, like the fourth millennia, the greater light will become visible, that sort of thing. I mean, you know, you're talking about, there's spiritual aspects to it, there's physical aspects to it, and they're all right. They're all accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, what a big accident.
Yeah, wow. Larry, there are several aspects of the creation account that blew me away. You know, the initiation of light and how energy ultimately coalesced into matter was one of them. The references to relativity on the second day was one of them. The fourth day, going from being inaccurate to profound, when you understand that the sun and the moon weren't created on the fourth day, but that the greater and lesser light became visible to us as a sign of the Moed on the fourth day, and then you realize that on the fourth millennia of human history, after being expelled from the garden, the greater light, Yahweh, appeared in our world to fulfill the first four Moed Mikre in the fourth millennia of human history, exactly as predicted in the fourth day of
creation.
Right
off the bat. Right
and
off the bat predicted.
And you go,
yeah.
Oh my goodness, score one for God.
And then from the physical aspect, and you do point this out, that's exactly how it would have worked, because you would have had all this volcanic activity,
right,
and all this smoke in the air, and basically the plants would have eaten it, and they would have eaten all that carbon out of the air, and at that point it would have became translucent, so we could see the moon and the sun.
Right.
And that's physically the way it would have happened. So there's spiritual, there's physical, and it's all laying it out. And if you can't tie Moed and the fourth millennia from the fall of Adam to that, then you know, you don't understand what's happening here.
It gives me goosebumps.
And that fifth day when all the great religions are born.
I know.
Whoa.
Amazing. Serpents
and snakes.
Right. And that's exactly what happened in the fifth millennia of human history after the expulsion from the garden. It's exactly when they were all born. And that the sixth time being the ultimate celebration of man, as man approaches God, that's our time. And look at the tools that we have. Look at how easy it is now for us to complete the equation, as we're so close to the seventh day. It's marvelous. And then, of course, when you realize that the cosmic microwave background radiation from that Big Bang that Yahweh talks about, and the fact that Yahweh uses the term Big Bang is pretty impressive to me. But when you realize that time at the point of creation was stretched to 10 to the 12th power. That is the relative perspective on time. The time flow moved 10 to the 12th times slower at creation from the perspective of the creator. And then you do the math and you take 15 billion years multiplied by 365 and a quarter days per year, and you do the math and divide that by 10 to the 12th, and you get 6 24-hour days.
Yeah, I explained that to somebody, and his response was, well, you could take numbers and make it whatever you want.
No, that's called relativity.
You have a specific number, 10 to the 12th, that is derived from the cosmic microwave radiation emanating out of the Big Bang. And you divide that by what that number tells us, which is that the Earth from the time of the Big Bang is 14 billion years old, but it's only measuring time from the time that light coalesced into matter, when there was a possibility of actually a bang, knowing that therefore there's period of time before the coalition of energy into matter, that you have two known numbers, 14 to 15 billion years. Not a guess, not an approximate, not someone's just playing fun with numbers. That's the number. That's how old the universe is, between 14 and 15 billion years. 14 billion years since the transition of energy into matter, and about a billion years prior to that, 14 to 15 billion years. In fact, there's about 20 different ways to evaluate the age of the universe. They all come between 14 and 15 billion. That's
and there's four different ways to measure that 10 to the 12th power, and they all come out to 10 to the 12th power.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Right. And then you understand the way time rolls out.
Right.
And, you know,
just
boom,
do the math.
We're
and
here.
All you've got to do
yeah.
is, I mean, you know, this idea that you can say anything you want to with numbers is stupid. That's the one thing about math that is very appealing. Math is exacting. 2 + 2 is always 4. 4 / 2 is always 2. Always. Math is exacting. And so it's interesting that Yahweh used the one exacting communication medium, mathematics, to prove precisely that he was there and that his timeline is precisely accurate. You know, there is no fudging with numbers. You can't make numbers do whatever you want them to do. Math is exacting. There is no such thing as outcome-based math.
Yeah, right. Even look at the way he represents. The one thing we do know that we still see today, or images of it today, is the menorah. You know, with the 22 almonds, which represent,
right.
you know, I'm quite
the
sure
22 letters
the
in the alphabet.
Alphabet.
Right.
Yeah, and then you divide 7 into that, what do you get? You get eternity. You get pi.
Right.
So you got an eternal light.
Right.
Here's my picture. Here it is, an eternal light. I'm sure
right.
that was a big accident, too.
Yeah. Oh, you know, it's when you deal with the math, the numbers, for example, the 6 + 1 formula and the 6,000 years from the time that Adam and Chawa were expulsed from the garden, it'll be exactly 6,000 years or 6 days from as it is 6 steps to Yahweh before we enter the millennial Shabbat. And when you deal with the precision of the formula and the mathematics and his communication to us, if it does not resonate with you, you can't be reached. So the person who told you that, William, that you know you can say anything you want to with numbers, the answer to that is no, you can't. That's the reason the numbers are so important.
Not with relativity, you
yeah.
can't.
Math is an exacting number, communication medium, and if you are not moved by that math, then there is no chance that anything God says or anything that I say on his behalf
mm-hmm.
is capable of reaching you. Now,
yeah,
I will
that's
tell
what
you,
it was.
I will tell
when
you,
I first understood that, when I read the Or chapter and yada yada,
yes.
I went to bed that night shocked.
Yeah.
Shocked. I was in shock. I was going, whoa, it turns out all this is real.
Yeah.
This is all real.
That was what won me over at the beginning.
Yeah. Got
you. Yeah, thank you, JB, because that's the rational response to that. I mean, that's
was
it.
Like from agnostic to, you know, accepting that God existed. Not believing, knowing that God existed. At that point,
right.
there was no
Oh, yeah, this is all real now.
Right.
Yeah,
this is all real
it.
Now. Yeah, this is all real now. And then the three of us, once we came to know, this is all real now. And there's, by the way, yes, that's a powerful affirmation, but there's tens of thousands of affirmations. I mean, they're just all over the place. And then you come to the realization.
That's the first one that slapped you upside down.
We're all on the court there. Okay. God proved his existence, and he proved that he authored the Torah with that bit of math. Proved it.
Oh, just that math alone, but then you
period.
Get into the
then,
dimensions
then the
of the
only
apart,
thing that matters,
all that
yeah, then the only thing that matters yeah. is, who is he, and what did he have to say? That's all that matters.
What do I
got
to do to meet this guy? You know, that's it.
Yeah. And if you look at where we've all come based upon that simple realization, that there's nothing more important than coming to know who he is, what he had to say, and figuring out if he provided a means for us to meet him, that's all that matters.
Yeah, I got a question here in the chat room from Lisa7 here. Okay, here it is. Yada, have you figured out the poetic riddle of throwing the harps into the air, into the willows, while they wept by the rivers of Babylon yet? Have you?
No.
I thought I was not aware of.
I haven't even thought of it. But I'll tell you what, if he writes me, it's yada at yadaya.com, yadaya.com, and she cites the, I can Google the passage and find it, but if she poses that question, I promise I will, I'll look into it. I'm...
Psalms 137, she wrote.
Okay. And I'll be glad to look into it. One of the challenges of the Psalms is there's many of them that are very well memorialized in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but the Psalms are sort of like Yashayat in the sense that, oh boy, you really have to pay attention to the Dead Sea Scrolls to translate the Psalms. So if 137 is amongst the Dead Sea Scroll collection, I'll have a shot at it. If it isn't, I'm uncomfortable because they're so badly maligned by the Masoretes. But I'll try.
Well, and the Psalms add a whole different challenge because they are written as poetry, and so a lot of words you don't see in other places. The style's different than in, say, the Torah. It is very different than everything else because it is poetry.
Correct. It is poetry.
I got a question.
By the way,
you guys.
Hebrew poetry, though, is very different. It's not, there's no, Hebrew poetry is not written for rhyme or rhythm. Hebrew poetry is written with the notion of you're going to say the same thing twice using different words from a different perspective. That's why when I was comparing mitzvah to the Yahweh you desire close personal relationships, this is Hebrew poetry, and in Hebrew poetry, those two sentences have to reinforce one another.
Yeah, but that's why, like I said, you get words you don't see anywhere else. It becomes real hard, to look up, like you say before, you look at the first time Yahweh uses a word, and you can usually define it, but you come across words in the Psalms that don't appear anywhere else.
Yes.
Yeah. It's because of that, where they're trying to say the same thing. So you use the previous verse or the next verse to understand it, but it's a much bigger challenge than anything else in Yah's Word.
Yeah, it is, with the exception of the fact that most of what's in the Psalms is shared, where the same thought is shared using different words from a different perspective, so that if you're translating the Psalms in context, you have a much better chance to render.
Wayne,
you had a question.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this, and I was just wondering what your question would be. Like, when we're finally home with Yah, I'm going to ask him why did we have to why did we have to do the Moed Mikveh and everything? Like, why did it have to be that way?
Oh, why were you talking about during the millennial Shabbat, or you're talking about during eternity?
In eternity. Like, I want to ask him, and if I hope I'm not out of line. I mean, I don't want to disrespect him, but I want to know why. Why did it have to be that way?
Oh, you're talking about why? I mean, I'm going to understand your question.
Why
did Yahweh establish the Moed Mikre here for us to, as the means for us to engage in a relationship with him versus some other approach?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
The reason for the Moed Mikre is that Yahweh had to come up with a plan to make us perfect, because he can't adopt us into his family unless we are perfect. He had to come up with a way to make us perfect without being capricious. And so the way to do that was, because if you just forgive somebody who has done something inappropriate, then what you end up with is an unjust system, a system that where the good and the bad are treated the same, where right and wrong receives the same response. And so God is just and he is perfect, so he had to come up with a plan whereby those of us who are unjust, who are in rebellion, can be reconciled and our relationship can be vindicated, but not in a capricious manner. So there had to be a way that God could remain just, remain consistent, and honestly be able to exonerate certain individuals. And the way that he did that is he said, what if I myself pay the penalty and endure the consequence? If I myself take on the rebellion of my children, and I suffer the consequence, which is death, and I suffer the penalty, which is separation, then I can be just because I have paid the price. I have paid the penalty. I have suffered the consequence. And because I have done that, I can now exonerate them. And so it was the most perfect, most generous solution that enabled God to be totally and completely just, completely and totally honest, and yet have him be the sacrificial father that sacrifices himself on behalf of his children. And you begin with those two, and that therefore enables the third, which is adoption, which is the whole purpose. And then why the fourth?
And it's not only that, we're back to free will again. There are certain people that are going to accept that kind of generosity, and apparently certain other people are not.
Correct. And so you've got a doorway that you have to choose to walk through. And you've got a welcome mat that you have to choose to walk across that resolves those problems so that we can be adopted. And then the fourth one is so essential. The reason the fourth one, now these first two, of course, are God himself making the sacrifice like a loving father on behalf of his children. So that he can be completely just and completely fair, because he himself paid the penalty. He himself endured the consequence, death and separation. Then you go to adoption, which is the entire purpose of the universe. But then the fourth is so essential, is that moed tells us that the entire purpose of adopting us into his family isn't just saying, okay, I got a bunch of babies now in my family. I don't have a dad, I guess. No, the reason that we conceive children and we raise them in a family is that we want our children to grow, to be enriched, to be empowered. And that's what the fourth moed is God saying to us, I'm inviting you into my family because I want to enrich you. I want to empower you.
Right.
And then the fourth is just so essential, because once you're part of the family, once you've been enriched with his teaching and empowered by his spirit, and you're celebrating your relationship with him, what is your most passionate desire? The thing that you do every day, William,
mm-hmm.
is to share.
Yeah.
That's what the fourth one is all about. The fifth one.
There's something that should be pointed out here too. When you're sitting here, the fifth one. It gets a little tired sharing Yahweh's words with somebody that doesn't want to listen, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it just absolutely gets boring. At some point, you just don't even want to talk to them anymore. Certainly,
I'm not going to read to a brick wall. Person ever.
Yeah, let me go one other step for you. One other thought, William, on this. The moed were specifically designed. I'm going to give you two more thoughts. The moed were specifically designed to show what God was taking us away from and taking us to. The moed, the first celebration of Pesach, was the liberation from death and the crucible of Egypt. And the second was the liberation of religion and politics and the militarism and the economic schemes that enslaved the children of Israel, and God liberating us from all of that gunk. That's the second step along the way. And so God is trying to tell us this is the path from human institutions that are so enslaving and so corrupting that I have designed that frees you and perfects you. It's such a marvelous plan. Now, I want to speak just briefly of the sixth, which is that while we are the beneficiaries of those first five and will ultimately be the beneficiaries of the seventh, I've become more and more convinced that the sixth is for Yahweh's Yisraelite family. That ultimately he wants to honor the promise that he made to Abraham, and that he's going to reconcile his relationship with Yisrael and with Yehuda. And that we are all playing a role in that. But that is something that God has made as a promise, and that's what the Day of Reconciliations is all about. And that so collectively, all of us, those who have been adopted and ultimately naturally born into the family, can celebrate camping out with him, which is the entire purpose of creation, is so that we can camp out together for all time. And those Moed play out on six steps to God leading to the desired result. Everything in God's formulation, including creation, including time, is on that same plan of 6 + 1 = 7. That's why the Moed. Now, I'm going to give you one more reason. The Moed Mikre are based upon a meeting with God, which is what he wants us to do. He wants us to meet with him. They are about being invited to be called out, to read and recite his testimony, and to be welcomed into his presence. God is inviting us into his family. That's what the Moed represent. He's inviting us to do this very thing this psalm said, to take advantage of the fact that he's approachable and desirous of close personal relationships. The Moed make that possible.
The Moed are for us.
They are for us.
Yeah, they're for us.
They're his Moed. They're his meetings. They are for us.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think will be the answer. Now, he will be more articulate than I, but I think those are the things that he's going to share as to why the Moed. Now, during the millennial Shabbat, they will continue to be celebrated. In fact, they'll be celebrated perfectly during the millennial Shabbat. And I suspect that we will be celebrating the Moed using Earth time in eternity, because of what they mean to us, because it's a great opportunity to get together with God and celebrate parts of our relationship. I think they will exist for all time.
Oh yeah, he said they will.
Yeah, I think they'll exist for all time. I think we'll be celebrating them forever.
I think so.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Why wouldn't we want to?
That's exactly right.
That's something I plan on celebrating for all eternity.
Yep. Fellas, it's half past time. My wife has sent my my four-legged friend, my dog, down to get me, because it's time for me to take her out to dinner. It's something I promised to do. And so I'm going to do it. Well, I love talking with you all, and I can stay with you forever.
Okay.
My wife does mean more to me than this is family first.
Leave you there.
Wife first. I'm going to go take my wife out to dinner.
Have a good time.
Larry, thank you for participating. James, thank you for participating. And William, it is just always wonderful to have you call in to hear your
voice. Hey, man, I missed you guys. I'm glad I called in.
Me too.
Yeah, all right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
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 Bye.